So we're talking about Lake Holiday Park, Lake Hawea Holiday Park. That's awesome.
Right, well, now that we've moved off Loch Linnhe,
Ach, no.
We can move on to Glendean. How are your holiday park? I'll probably, just to make sure that I've got on record, that I understand your concerns on this site
sure.
as well. My question is probably much the same as for Loch Linnhe, in that I think even in your summary, you've put them together certain similarities between
yes.
what's come forward. So there's been no detailed assessment of the landscape sensitivity and capacity again for this site. I mean, there's been, particularly in terms of things like the location and width of buffers from the road and the lake and the treatment of that northern area.
Yes, that's correct. I think in fairness to Mr. Espy, he's had a crack at mapping the sensitivity, and that has been used as a basis for their building height limitations and a BRA and setback along the state highway. I disagree with his sensitivity mapping.
He doesn't actually bring it forward exactly as a sensitivity analysis, not portrayed as that. It's portrayed as this BRA strip, very definite 15-metre strip, which would be hard to imagine coinciding exactly with the high sensitivity
yes.
area.
Yes,
and then the other is just, there are two high limit areas.
Yes, that's right. I think maybe it's helpful to explain that as a landscape architect, to be honest, I found this quite difficult to work with these two sites with the RVZ. And there's probably a fundamental thing that might help the panel to understand is the landscape assessment work that informed the RVZ provisions related to existing zoned areas. It wasn't articulated in a manner to do with greenfield RVZ areas. And I agree with the way that Ms. Malsop undertook that assessment, but it doesn't necessarily have a natural morph, if you like, to greenfield RVZ. And so I guess I came back to the fundamental landscape test of appropriateness. But also, because of the way the zone's written, tried to articulate that in terms of landscape sensitivity.
I
don't know if that
saying.
Helps.
I don't know what we can do about that other than to fit a landscape assessment to see if it's possible to fit landscape assessment into the mechanisms that the RVZ requires.
That's right. I guess it speaks to why, in some situations, it's quite difficult and there's quite a nuanced landscape approach recommended.
And when you start looking at some of the bigger sites, of which neither of your two are, then suddenly you need another layer of nuancing in terms of how to direct development.
That's right.
Just using the sensitivity assessments, like I discussed with Mr. Jones, for the two big sites he looked at, just relying on those areas isn't enough.
Absolutely. I'd call it a pretty blunt instrument in terms of landscape analysis.
Which might be fine for a small, discrete, existing area which has already got existing development on it.
that's exactly right, or is particularly discrete, or But scale is really important.
And then, I mean, beyond the fact that you don't think that Mr. Espy has done a full and complete landscape assessment, and leading on to, as best we can on this site, a sensitivity analysis, or even a more detailed analysis about where development might go within that. He has the level of development that the provisions that the submitter is asking for. I think you're the one that talks about 31,500 buildings. So, and they would be controlled activity throughout the zone, no protection for the trees, and you're saying that no assessment's been done of that by Mr. Espy.
I'm not aware of any assessment of that. And as I say, for both sites, I kind of think, you know, they're in ONLs, a landscape-led approach should generate the zoning outcome. And in terms of site coverage at Lake Kawia Holiday Park, I mean, you know, something that's critical to the character of that site and influences the ONL around it, the values of the ONL around it, is the kind of very leafy and heavily treed character. So I would have thought you'd investigate, well, how much of that site isn't in vegetation coverage, and then start thinking about building coverage.
And you would need, I mean, is it your opinion that without going through these steps and refining and nuancing the provisions for that site, then provisions can't be developed for a zone that would assure us that the ONL values would be protected?
Absolutely.
And I mean, thank you for what you've done. You've tried, from your understanding of the site, saying, well, again, you don't think that this is impossible, and you've given some direction as to the way forward, but that needs to then come from the submitter to show us how that would be achieved in a way that does protect the ONL values.
That's right. Yeah. So I think a modest scale of built development is a really important.
Yes, and protecting both the lakeside and the highway.
Yes.
Visibility, yes. Making sure it's maintained some level of leafiness, as you said.
Yeah. There. Yeah.
And keeping away from that northern little area.
Yes, definitely.
Do you consider this site to be remote?
No, not in the sense of the other RVZs that I'm aware of, and certainly within a normal ONL context in this district. However, it is, to my mind, set apart from Hawea settlement.
Okay.
And I think I talk about that in my evidence in chief, actually.
We can find it.
Yeah, it's buried in
this just because of the way it is, there are ONL areas which come right to the boundaries of urban areas.
Yes.
Equals close to, which may not be considered remote in the sense of being remote from other urban areas. But then there are at the other extreme, there are areas that are extremely remote.
That's right. It's probably more a planning conversation. And just to sort of pick up on that, I guess the other thing is the holiday park is a form of visitor-type use already, in a sense. You know,
yes.
That land use is part and parcel of the character of it.
And it is enabling people to access and enjoy the O&L landscape and the lake.
That's right.
And my final and more specific question is that you appear to accept that glamping tents could be exempt from any building or colour and texture or materials type external adherence rules. I mean, when we went there in June, I mean, the glamping, whatever one might, I don't know how you define glamping, but they were still there on the site. So it's not like to my view, they're not something that's taken down between users or even seasonally, from what I was able to see. Putting aside the difficulty of defining what's a glamping tent versus another tent, which I'll ask Ms. Grace about, if those tents and their platforms and structures were there all year round, do you think they should be treated any differently than a building when it comes to external appearance?
No. I had assumed that the glamping tents would be taken down. I'm aware of one glamping outfit over in near Mount Barker where they do take the tents down every year in, you know, sort of April-ish. If they're there year round, they should be subject to the same colour controls.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all my questions on
Ms. Gilbert, when we went on our on our site visit with your evidence in chief in mind, and with Mr. We followed the boundary of the legal land, and it seemed to me that there are areas where the lot between the council leased land and the state highway, there are areas where there is a significant difference in elevation where it seemed that a relatively small buffer might be quite adequate because the road's a long way above the camping ground, and also because the grass has already been mown, which would suggest that it's already used for camping anyway, would be in summer. Whereas further, just a little bit further down the road, there is very little difference in elevation, and where it appeared to me that you would need either a sizable buffer or significant landscaping or both.
Yeah.
Now, if I understand your point, it's those nuances that effectively Mr. Espy needs to consider and draw us a plan as to what is more sensitive, where and why.
Yes.
And then we can start talking about zone provisions which utilise the less sensitive areas.
Yes, you have. Yeah, that's correct. And what I would say is about that buffer along the highway, it's important in terms of views out to the lake, but it's also important in terms of views from the lake and from the lakefront back towards the site, so that you don't get development creeping up the slopes in those views. So, you know, you retain that very, what I think I call a, you know, kind of a green node of development. And it doesn't read as an extension of Hawea settlement. There is actually really detailed LIDAR contour data on the council website for that part of the district. And when you go into that, the landform is quite organically shaped, I suppose. It's not a engineered embankment, which you'd kind of assume might be the case from the setback.
In other words, beware of a straight line.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is fundamentally unnatural.
Yes, definitely. There's some very strong, obvious topographic and vegetative cues to what would be an appropriate boundary through there.
Commissioner McLeod.
Yep, just on those boundaries, as they were, on your evidence in chief, your figure four,
sorry, page.
Figure four on page 22.
Thank you. Yes.
Yep. So I think we can all simply potentially ignore lot one. So if you come down to below where the lake overflow is, the flood level, and then there's this on the roadside between the yellow line.
Yes.
There's a track that sort of follows and goes up and down quite a bit, but I don't know if you're on the site, you actually. Because I walked that track.
Yes.
And that would seem to be, like, I'm not, again, putting, but just like your opinion of, a much more effective, potentially an effective, if you're doing it at a setback. So there's certain areas that are much wider, certain areas that are much narrower. It does seem to follow the contour. At the top end, it goes up over, so it goes a bit closer to the road, but there's quite a lot of natural vegetation there. Are you aware of it, and did you?
Yes, I am aware of it, but I probably wouldn't choose that as as the line. I think I would be excluding a fair bit of that area because of the vegetation patterning, and I'm reluctant to tell you where I'd draw the line without having the contours.
So the contours would be what?
The contours are really helpful in this situation, but I also think the other determinant is kind of the existing campground footprint, and that's straying northwards to my mind into an area that isn't really kind of inhabited, if you like, to the same degree. My understanding of the Burdens evidence for stage one, I think, was that really what they wanted to do was, you know, 8 or 9 geodesic domes. I think there's ample scope to locate those somewhere in existing clearings.
It's interesting you mentioned domes because they were doing quite a bit of work when we were at the site, and it seems to be flat platforms that are being built, each with what looks like a shower unit or a next to. I was wondering if that was the potential. I think this is within the campground, so it's probably just a arrangement.
I'm not aware of that, but I know that any development they do, they have to get a consent from council, so Ms. Grace may be able to help you with that.
And the geodesic dome would be something that you would say would fit within the environment that is the campground and the spaces that are there, even if it was spread further up on lot 2 or?
I better be careful what I say there because I don't know what these geodesic domes look like.
You brought them out.
Yeah, but just in principle, they sounded like quite modest structures. And if I was locating them as a landscape architect, I would look for existing clearings within the confines of the existing campground footprint. To locate them, and I expect that you could probably find some appropriate locations, assuming they're not, that they're relatively visually discrete structures in their own right.
Yeah, and just with regard to the glamping tents, you mentioned Mount Barker, so I can't resist not dive in again. Some of those were white.
Yes.
And
yes.
Even though they're there for a short period, being white, and it'd be interesting in your opinion, because you could draw your eye around the basin and paint it like they were.
Yes, yeah, it's an interesting one, and it's come up in some other circumstances that I've been involved in. I guess there's a a perception that camping tents are more transitional. They're a short-term, temporary type structure, if you like, in the landscape, and suggesting a greater tolerance for that visibility. There's probably different schools of thought on that, though, yeah, I acknowledge.
And have you been to Camp Lanorkey at all?
Yes, yeah.
Because
yes,
that's possibly my best example of glamping, and that's with a double bed and sideboards and tables, and it's anything but impermanent.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm aware of some out on the west coast in Auckland, and they're all taken down in the wintertime. Yeah, as I say, I think if they're staying all year round, you need to apply the colour controls, which of course makes them very hot in the summertime.
Sure. Final question. In your rebuttal, you talk about a generous landscape buffer and a spacious landscape buffer, generous one being on the highway edge and the spacious one being on the lakefront edge. Is there a material difference between generous and spacious? What would it be if it was?
Yes, I think in terms of the I think there is a bit of a difference in those two buffer treatments. I think the road edge is going to require an appropriate planting strategy, and I think the lake edge, you actually do want that permeability in places to sort of, you know, sort of that informality of a bit of grassland and, you know, sort of, I'm not explaining this very well, but a varied...
more permeable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do love the term appropriate. Because if I spoke to Lake Wanaka Tourism, they would think that Dreamliner flights into Wanaka would be appropriate.
Behave yourself, Callum.
At that point, I
blame it on the RMA.
We're off to Universal. Universal Studios.
You're going to start on the front? I'm happy to.
Well, if you... I'm still trying to find it, why don't you start?
Me too.
Yes, found it.
I've got some questions about the defensible boundaries. Putting to one side the whole concept of a big expansion of Haumea, just looking at the boundaries. We went and had a look at it, and we saw the water race, and it didn't have any water in it. Because it doesn't in the winter time.
Yeah.
It gets turned off. It wasn't overwhelmingly attractive. So how effective do you think the water race is or could be made to be as a defensible boundary for the south edge of an expansion of Haumea?
Sure. I think it needs to be augmented with a minimum 15 metre width, building restriction area and combined with a landscape buffer. I guess the water race... And I don't know, and I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong on this, but I would imagine it's unlikely to be filled in because it affects the irrigation of...
I mean, it might be piped, but they do
things
like that
all over
the country, actually, to avoid losing the water into the groundwater. But it might not be.
It is there. It's also, to my mind, quite an organic edge, which is beneficial in terms of the identity of Haumea. So I think it's workable. I think it's preferred over a simple 15 metre width buffer applied to a cadastral boundaries.
It doesn't matter that there's no water in it for half a year. I mean, the bet would be augmented, I think you said, by landscape plantings and
walkway. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of other examples around the country where ephemeral streams are relied on as a starting point, if you like, for a defensible edge. Maybe it has a fitting with that. It definitely requires the, a buffer to support it.
But if you don't, say, use that, that is the main or the only, I suppose, topographic feature.
Yeah, it's, yeah,
for
that's
a long
right.
way. Other than, yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And on the eastern edge, again, you've said that's a difficult edge to provide a defensible boundary because you just go into another paddock and then another paddock before you eventually go to.
Yes, that's right.
And you're saying if this was to happen, it would need again to have a 15-metre landscape planted edge created down there that sort of gave, it wasn't just a lot of some rows of trees, it actually formed quite an organic buffer.
Yes.
Do you think with that in mind, is it possible for that to be a defensible buffer in this locality? Or is it just a buffer that could then be hopped over fairly easily?
Well, I think what you've got going on the eastern side is the Gladstone Gap flood hazard area as well.
Yes, but to say that's not very
strong.
Not very strong.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of
it. The flood is just so low that you could put a town there.
I think 15 metres is a reasonable width to prevent that creep. But, I see these buffers, there might be a time in the future where, for example, council and the community decide how here should be the new Queenstown, I don't know, and they want to go
Sorry, yes.
And they want to go beyond that buffer.
Please.
The buffer can be integrated into a future development because it will have an open space, an open space function, walkway, cycleway, that sort of thing. So
it would provide as strong a boundary as one could get in the meantime.
Yes.
But it's not so definitive that it couldn't be moved beyond if the community decided to.
Yeah, that's right. But it would be robust in the meantime.
Okay.
Yeah.
You sort of seem to be in two minds about the implications of a development of this scale on the character of Hawea settlement. You've talked about it would certainly be changing if it hasn't changed already from the old school lakeside settlement, given what's already in that Tim's Field. The north of Cemetery Road area. If the full universal proposal went ahead, this would be a huge change of scale. It would be almost doubling, I think, the size of current Hawea, potentially. But then on the other hand, you say the horse is starting to bolt. We've got the SHA, even though it hasn't actually been developed, it's been approved, but it's not happening on the ground, and the Domain Acres is happening on the ground now. Mr. Barr has suggested that that he could potentially support, I'm not quite sure, he'll tell me how strongly he supports, a scale of development down to the water race, in the suggested boundaries. Which you've sort of said, if the panel is of a mind to allow this development, these are the boundaries that you would suggest. What is your opinion in terms of the effect on the character of Hawea of a development of the scale Mr. Barr suggests down to the water road.
Well, I guess I'm taking as part of the existing environment the approved SHA, which is 400 and something odd houses, and then domain acres. And if you take it down to the water race, you're really kind of just filling in the gaps between those two. And there's a little bit further to the south of the SHA. There's a change to the character of Hawea settlement that's going to occur as a consequence of those two developments. And the incremental change, if you like, is I don't think it's such that it's unacceptable from a landscape perspective.
That's the evidence. He's talking about the submission.
Submission. I mean, the picture may be in the evidence as well. In fact, I think it is. Apologies. Universal developments. Well, that's it. That should have it. Yep. And just back on there. I was just wanting to bring that part right. While you were waiting for. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Nice time. Commissioner. Is there any left? After Mr. Dawson.
Sorry.
I suppose I'd like to talk about using the water race as a line, picking up on Commissioner Dawson's point. If we were to do that, are we inviting it to be piped and then in state? stage 15 of the proposed district plan reviews. Another application to carry on towards Hawea Flat?
Well, I wonder if there might be a way around that, which is that if you had a structure plan for the area, it would identify the buffers and the water race itself and you know, the public walkways and those normal other things that a structure plan typically shows and reserve areas. And that might go some way to kind of securing the retention of it.
Commissioner Dawson's covered my other questions.
Yeah, I was just, because I'm interested in the, and it follows on from the water race as a defensible boundary.
Yeah.
And you mentioned prefer over a cadastral boundary, but cadastral boundaries at least are a fixed line, whereas the water race, as has been alluded to, can come and go. And if the water race wasn't there, if it was piped, what would suggest that that would be a place to have a buffer, an edge on the landscape?
Well, I guess, and actually it springs to mind that, so I did a site walkover with the landowner as well as some of their consultants. And as I understand it, the water race has got quite a history. And so I sort of see it as if you showed it in the structure plan, it's kind of part of the identity of that part of Hawea. And I'd hope that, you know, there were some provisions that talked about retaining the water race as quite a distinctive feature.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
I actually hope that the urban growth boundary would be the urban growth boundary. The reason I asked for this picture to be drawn out is that that is the universal one of the applications to find the area, and if you look at the area versus the existing town of Hawea, I think there's somewhere you make a term about an old school lakeside, and from a landscape perspective, that sort of scale of change certainly has more of an impact on school development.
It does.
And if, again putting boundaries on it, the eastern boundary is somewhat indefensible because of the Gladstone Gap, is there any, from a landscape perspective, how would you then put a defensible edge on the eastern boundary?
So the 15 metre building restriction area and landscape buffer, which
a cadastral boundary.
Yes, although I had tried to articulate in my evidence that it should actually follow the line of the Gladstone Gap flood hazard, because I understand from the submitter's evidence, landscape evidence, that they're relying on that as their defensible edge to the eastern side. And it wasn't until I looked at the SHA and realised the SHA breaches that I thought, oh, how's that working?
I've asked myself the same question.
and so I guess, just sort of taking it back a step or two, in terms of defensible edges, you're looking for the best possible one you can in each instance. Sometimes you really struggle to find a defensible edge. And so on that eastern side, I see the flood hazard mapping wiggly line combined with a 15 metre buffer being, you know, the best possible outcome that we can find.
Did you, just another question, I know, I'm not sure if it's a landscape to keep brief, but did you look at any of the soil mapping in the area?
Yeah, I did. And my understanding is the land west of Domain Road is pretty good, and that's where all the pivot irrigators and what have you are. But the actual Universal Development site is poorer soils, but I'm not a soils expert.
I don't think that's consistent with Mr. Barnes either.
No. I think I've read that in the submitter's evidence, and they had some mapping.
Mr. Barr covers that, hasn't he?
Yeah, I'm not a soils expert at all.
I didn't realise Mr. Barr was a soils expert, but we'll get to him.
He does have some maps.
The would, in your opinion, would soil mapping constitute as equivalent or as good a edge as a cadastral boundary or potentially a waterways?
In terms of a legible, defensible edge, unless it was reflected in the land use, it would be pretty hard. It may be a strong reason to align a defensible edge in a location, but to read it on the ground.
I take your point, but if you look to the south of the highlighted area, those circles on the ground are very readable. But they've only just arrived in the last decade. It's just reflection more than.
Well, I actually talk about that edge in my rebuttal, in that because it's so flat and close to the settlement, and there's the Hawea River corridor to the west.
Yeah.
I think it would be a pretty plausible argument to say, well, actually, why aren't we using the Hawea River as the defensible edge? I don't know whether this... Look, I'm not a soils expert to advise you if that would stand up, but even where there's very high-quality soils, say on Pukekohe Hill, it hasn't been determinative, as I understand it, of defensible edges.
Thank you.
Do we have anything more from Ms. Gould? Thank you very much for your assistance, as always.
Thanks.
So next we have Ms. Hampson, and the only evidence that you'll hear from her now is on the same site, Universal.
And that's in rebuttal?
It is in her rebuttal, yes, 12th of June, I think.
So paragraph 11 of my summary of evidence. I do not support the proposed general industrial zone in Hawea, sought by Universal Developments Limited. The wider economic benefits of consolidating industrial and service activity in Wanaka outweigh any opportunity costs for additional employment and shorter travel distance for the local Hawea community. In my view, the relatively large general industrial zone proposed in Hawea would not make strategic sense from an economic and zoning perspective. I support the proposed local shopping centre zone in Hawea by Universal Developments. While there is a reported surplus of commercial and retail capacity in the Wanaka ward, there would be net economic benefits to the Hawea community from the second centre.
scale of this proposed rezoning compared to how we are development projections, demand projections, and more than exceeding them. I think the submitter's argument is that this is meeting Wanaka demand. Is there a potential for development of this scale both to meet Wanaka demand and drive down Wanaka prices? And what's your comment on, is that likely and is that a good thing or not?
So the first part of your question, Hawea does help meet housing demand for the Wanaka catchment. It is a satellite of Wanaka, so any capacity created in Hawea benefits the wider Upper Clutha community because it is seen as a viable place to commute. I'm not aware that there is a shortfall of aggregate capacity for housing in the Wanaka ward or the district overall. So I'm not sure that we can confirm that it's addressing any shortfall. Any additional housing capacity does contribute to potentially affordable housing. Certainly the SHA that has been approved will deliver that through a defined mechanism. I'm not aware that the universal submission generally provides any specific mechanisms for affordable housing, but Hawea is more affordable relative to other parts of central Wanaka.
Behind my question was that if the universal development proceeded and significantly oversupplied the market, supply and demand would suggest that prices would drop.
That is the theory.
Yes.
It's not always the reality in a way. All developers have certain returns that need to be made, and flooding the market with all of that capacity in the same time would probably not meet the economic viability of development. It is likely, as we've seen with all greenfield developments, that they will be staged. And while it does provide perhaps an alternative greenfield growth area, each landowner within that submission area will need to consider the timing of when it will be most efficient to develop.
Cover that in your evidence,
yes.
Don't you, in
yes,
response
I do.
To the other economists?
Yes, in regards to Mr. Copeland.
Yes, where he's talking about the fact that this could create competition with various landowners, but he said it doesn't always work that way.
No.
Indeed. I think you're talking about provision of shopping centres own land. You say seeks that 3.5 hectares of land within the approved SHA be zoned LSCZ. Does the SHA already provide for that, or is that something different to what's in the SHA?
So I was involved in the subdivision consent hearing for the SHA recently. At the time of subdivision consent, and this is as I understand it, they requested that the shopping centre be approved at that point in time. The decision, whilst they accepted the benefits of the local shopping centre, which I supported through the consent process, they decided there was insufficient information on which to determine effects, and so they defaulted to amalgamating the lots so that it wouldn't preclude a local shopping centre in the future. So it was a matter of insufficient information. So it has been recognised as part of the SHA, and this submission, as I understand it, is a continuation of trying to achieve that outcome.
It's helpful. That's all I have. Mr. Dawson.
I was going to ask a similar question to the chair about the scale of demand versus the scale of this proposal versus the projected medium-term demand. And what I understood from your answer, that the demand for housing in Hawea as a satellite town for people working in Wanaka is already taken into account in the housing development capacity assessment. In other words, the cumulative or agglomerated demand for the Wanaka-Hawea area has been looked at as a whole.
Yes, it has, yes. And as have the growth projections that the council have for Hawea and the wider Hawea catchment. They reflect the types of households that will seek a location in Hawea, irrespective of where they may work,
yes.
or anything.
Yes. So it's not... can't say, well, this is Hawea's little projection, and oh, if some Wanaka people came, it would be different.
Yes,
it's all taken into account.
Yes, it is.
And you have some conditions or limitations that you recommend on the local shopping centre zone.
Mm-hmm.
And are they similar to those that are put on to some other zones, such as a zone up near the medical centre, I think it must be, on Cardrona Valley Road?
Yes, that's correct. various local shopping centre zones in the PDP have some extra exemptions to try and manage distributional effects,
yes.
And the scale of activity in any one location. So the recommendations I've identified as being appropriate are reflected in other examples. So
and
they're not new.
And that, as I understand, is to ensure that the benefits from the existing shopping centre location to the people that are sort of in that general catchment in the older part of Hawea are lost by having all new shopping going down into this location, and that there's a sort of distribution of benefits that
yes.
remains throughout the town.
Even though I suspect the growth would be focused on the new larger centre in the short term, by putting a 4,000 square metre cap on the retail, we provide opportunities for further retail growth to be directed to the existing centre sooner than would otherwise have been the case.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's all my questions.
Christian McLeod.
Interested in supply and demand, and there's currently a shopping centre in Hawea itself, which is not fully utilised.
No.
And it's, indeed, I think, a quarter of the space. I'm not exactly sure that I'll be able to figure out here, but it's not over 50% utilised. Is, on reflection, is this LSCZ does it just double the capacity, therefore it becomes a driver of a bigger area of housing development further south, if you see what I mean?
Are you saying will it stimulate even more growth than perhaps we might predict?
Is the area that's set aside
mm-hmm.
above the capacity of what is required?
Oh, just to serve the submission area? Yes, it is. It would need to serve the entire Hawea community in conjunction with the existing centre. Its customers will not be confined to the submission area. And I think that's that's important because, you know, this is quite a large centre compared to the one that is there at the moment, and it will need to, it will deliver benefits for everyone.
To the potential detriment of the other area?
No, I don't think it will undermine the viability of that existing zone to develop in time. It will perhaps develop more slowly, but it doesn't, it has a distinct, the existing one has quite a, I think a good opportunity in terms of its location. It's closer to the main entrance. From a tourism point of view, that might be the first centre that they come across. The other one will be more, I suspect, known to the residents. It's closer to the campground should they want to walk up into town. It's closer to the visitor accommodation subzones. I think it has a, you know, there's actually quite a good potential for it to develop a niche compared to the other centre. So I think it's certainly viable.
And also just interested in, you identify the Cadorna Valley Road shopping centre, local shopping centre, but in, you also specify, you know, and that has 300 square metres of ground floor area, which is equivalent to like a 4 square size supermarket. Would that be a fair estimation?
4 squares range. But yes, it would. Yeah,
a smaller scale, not like a New World. Or
no, certainly not not even a small scale supermarket. So I've suggested one tenancy that's 300 to 400, just to provide perhaps for a larger 4 square type grocery store to develop. But it's.
You know how big the new one at Albert Town is?
No, I don't. Sorry.
I think when we did the Cadorna Valley one, the 4 square in town was around about.
Yeah, it's a super rat.
Super rat.
Yeah.
The one in town.
Yep. The yellow store.
Including the back car.
Yes.
300 square metres.
Yeah, that would include the back area.
One of them is smaller. The Albert one is smaller than that.
Mm.
Yes, much.
But that sort of scale is what you're suggesting here, 300 to 400.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I think that would be ideally suited for that type of tenant. Obviously, it would be up to the developer what they use that rule for. But that would be a great anchor for a centre like this, and I think that's—I think that really is needed out there to help with self-sufficiency.
You don't look at including caps for office, ground floor area?
No, I don't think that. I think the risk of not doing that is very low.
Yep.
There's a lot of benefits for an office-based business to be centrally located in Wanaka, and Hawea, I just don't think will compete against that. Certainly, I think it would be great if there were some small office-based businesses, particularly upstairs from retail shops. I think they'll serve a local catchment, and this 200 square metre cap on those individual tenancies would be sufficient.
And just wondering, in your experience, and your economics hat on, urban growth boundaries, are they a good thing or a bad thing?
Commissioner, I think that they are what they are. They're on the plan.
Just putting it out there, in terms of economic growth, is it a stimulant or a deterrent? But if they are what they are,
I think if you provide sufficient capacity within them, then they're a perfectly effective mechanism of providing that separation and directing where growth will and won't occur. So in Auckland, where they've got the rural urban boundary, there is sufficient capacity zoned within that boundary for the next 30 years, and I think that works in Auckland. Obviously, others would argue that it should be removed and greenfield growth should go wherever it likes. But I think they're appropriate in this district, where there are a lot of landscape issues to be dealt with more sensitively than perhaps other locations.
Thank you.
Just one question for me, just very quickly. Just yesterday we talked about, I think it was yesterday, the size or the appropriate size of general industrial zones. I think in terms of the Arrowtown one thing in the greenfield, you probably wouldn't zone it. Here, looking at 9.2, I understand your reasons why your recommendation doesn't go ahead. But is 9.2 hectares, in this context, is that small? Or would you support something smaller in terms of a sort of a smaller scale local GIZ for Hawea?
9.2 is not small in my view, considering that the long-term demand for industrial land use in the Wanaka ward is 12.3, according to our estimates. That would be account for just about, you know, a good chunk of it. And no, I think the reasons why I don't support it, or even a smaller area, is that there are greater benefits to consolidating those activities in the major urban area.
Yeah. Thank you. That whole consolidation issue is consistent with what you said.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Hampson.
Is that it?
That's it.
Great.
Thank you. Thanks for your patience in coming back for 4 days.
Yes, sir. Frequent, isn't it? Always frequent.
So, Council's next expert is Mr. Bond. So, he has three statements of evidence. The first relates to the settlement zone and Arthur's Point. The second relates to the rural visitor zone. And then he has one rebuttal statement which covers all three areas. And you should have a highlight summary, I believe.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Would you like me to read my...
Please read your summary and then we'll go through.
No problem. I have prepared natural hazard evidence in relation to the rezoning submissions for the RVZ, Arthur's Point, and the settlement zone. In terms of the RVZ, for the Kerry Vivian for Heron Investments Limited, number 31014, I've reviewed the further evidence supplied by the submitter relating to geological faulting, and on the basis of this information, I do not oppose the rezoning of the entire site to RVZ. In terms of Arthur's Point, which is the Kerry Vivian for Robert Stewart, number 31038, I've reviewed the further evidence supplied by the submitter, and I've considered the assessment of risk associated with natural hazards. It is my opinion that the extensive, detailed investigations and assessment is still required in order to establish the overall stability and suitability of the site for development. However, I do concur that the foundations or other engineering solutions for future developments, whilst not standard, may be achieved that could lower the risk to acceptable levels. The associated cost of achieving these may, however, be prohibitive. In terms of the settlement zone, for Michael Lee for Cadrona Village Limited, number 31019. I've reviewed supplementary evidence, information relating to the potential flood risks at the site in terms of future development over the existing floodplain. It is my opinion that the proposal would result in a net loss of secondary overland flow paths for the Cadrona River, loss of the potential online flood storage, and would result in an increase in natural hazard risk to the adjoining land and downstream developments. Without further information pertaining to the quantification or mitigation of risk posed to adjoining land and downstream developments on the basis of flood risk, I would adopt a precautionary approach and oppose the rezoning request.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. First question relates to your rebuttal evidence. 12 June. I want to talk to you about the Stewart site. The council just recently approved and then changed a 30 lot subdivision on the immediately adjoining site that Ms. Malsop identifies the same landscape unit. First of all, two questions. Can we assume, if it's part of the same landscape unit, it's probably the same hazard? And while I understand you're adopting a suitably precautionary approach, if the council's seen fit to authorise a subdivision on the next site, how realistic is the risk on the Stewart site?
I'm not aware of the information that's been submitted on the approved application. I would assume that there's been a substantial level of geotechnical investigation or assessment of the landslide risk. In terms of Mr. Stewart's site, I'm very much aware that the landscape is typical of the toe of the landslide that forms the coronet block. So there are possibly similarities. However, it really comes down to the level of investigation and assessment in terms of the proposed mitigation measures or the proposed foundation solutions.
You put it around possible similarities. How likely is it that they'll be materially different?
It is possible, depending on the lobes of the landslide or the geomorphological form of the ground, and also the drainage conditions.
Cadrona Village, which is the following subject of your rebuttal evidence. In terms of risk to adjoining and downstream development, what is downstream? We'll put it another way. Well, maybe, first of all, if, as you say, there's a constriction in the an alteration of the pattern of flood, how far downstream is it realistic to be concerned about, and then what is in that area?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Without detailed modelling, it'd be difficult to ascertain. What we do know is that the Cadrona Valley is quite complex in terms of natural hazards, and a lot of the natural hazards overlap, so they have different effects. So, for example, landsliding can cause damming of the river, and damming of the river can then cause certain bursts of flow. The river is also prone to high levels of erosion, and during high peaks or high flows, during flood events, the river can move quite substantially and actually meander across the river across the valley floor, as was experienced during the 1999 floods. So in terms of the downstream effect, or the valley runs essentially from south to north towards Alberttown. And as you at the southern end of the valley, it's really quite steep and quite narrow. And as you progress down the valley, it opens out and flattens out towards Alberttown. During the 1999 floods and also subsequent flood monitoring at Alberttown, it was found that the Cadrona River actually had a substantial impact on the overall floods. So it can actually impact quite largely in terms of the overall flooding for the region. So I would say that any kind of downstream effect would need to be considered all the way through the valley.
In terms of those analysis of the 1999 floods, presumably that was a pure volume issue.
Yeah, I think it was. I don't know enough about the actual detail behind the 99 flood assessments, but I do know that the flow monitoring that they did through the Cadrona Valley and also along the Clutha was that the volumes were quite substantial. I think a lot of it was in terms of just the rapid sort of flow that came into the rivers at the time.
That's all I have, Commissioner Dawson.
I don't think I have any questions about Arthur's Point or Cadrona, but in your evidence in chief, you talk about some of the rural visitors'
own sites.
Yes.
Just with you, I mean, if you haven't taken these sites any further since then, just say that to me. You make some recommendations about the Loch Linney site, and I just wonder, have you seen the more recent proposal that's come in from the submitter on that site?
No,
the
I haven't.
Recommended removal of I think it's the creek, a strip of the creek going through that site.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to have happened in the latest version, or in the version from the submitter's evidence, but you haven't seen that.
No, I haven't.
I can't comment on that. Similarly with the Gibson Valley site, you identified some hazard areas there, and I wonder if you've had the opportunity to compare the plans that have come in from the submitter that identified developable areas and looked at those in relation to the hazard areas you identified and whether they avoid those areas that you identified.
No, I've not assessed those in detail, I'm afraid, sorry. However, I do remember that the Gibson Valley site, that the areas which I excluded were quite restricted to the channels, and that was primarily associated with typical debris flow events or flood events in those kind of channels that does happen. So I think if the development areas have avoided those, that would be a good thing.
Yes, it's quite likely that they have, even if it's for different reasons. And then on the Skippers site, which is, there are several sites in Skippers,
yep.
but the one we call it the Maligan site,
yep.
Not the most northerly site, but the one south there. Am I right that your evidence indicates that this is a moderate risk site, and that at the time of writing your evidence, there was no detailed assessment or no more information regarding the risk assessment and how that
that's correct.
Married in with the proposals for that site?
Yeah, that's correct. My assessment was drawn primarily off the back of desk-based information at the time, and also on my understanding of the geomorphology, typical geology, and other typical landforms in that area.
Yes, and you have no further information come forward to your knowledge on that site?
No.
Right, that's all. Thank you very much.
Mr. McLeod.
Nothing for me, thanks.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ball.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have one more technical expert to hear from, and that's Mr. Powell. And then we are down to only planners.
Only planners. How dare you even suggest both words in the same sentence?
Only, isn't it? One area.
There's only four of us. Only four planners.
Well,
no.
Ten.
Yep.
Ten planners.
Is there a collective noun for planners? A gaggle
ten.
Of planners?
Magnificent.
A magnificence of planners. There you go.
Maybe
not all the time. So Mr. Powell has evidence on, his evidence in chief covers the settlement zone and Arthur's Point North. And then his rebuttal evidence dated 12 June covers the settlement zone and again Arthur's Point North, and then rebuttal evidence dated 19th of June covers both the settlement zone and the rural visitor zone. So I think he has some discrete paragraphs.
Discrete summary.
Oh, he's got his whole summary to read to you. Thank you. Over to you.
Okay, good afternoon. So today I'll just be covering the two that I remain opposed to. These are the Universal Developments Hardware Limited and the Corbridge Estates Limited Partnership. First of all, Universal Developments Hardware Limited. The key reasons I oppose this submission, that the existing infrastructure already has constraints at the source for water and at the treatment plant for wastewater. There is no existing capacity for the increased demand that would result from if rezoning was granted. Second reason, the programmed future upgrades to remove existing constraints do not account for the increased demand that will result from granting of the rezoning, only for future development within the current growth boundary. A third reason, there are no funds allocated within the long-term plan to fund upgrades required for the increased demand. That's it for Universal Developments, if you
have. Yep, I think.
Okay, pushing on to Corbridge. Essentially the same three reasons, but different details, obviously for different sites. So again, the existing infrastructure doesn't have sufficient capacity for the increased demand. The future upgrades that are planned don't account for the increased demand. And again, there are no funds allocated in the LTP to fund upgrades required for the increased demand.
Well, I don't have any questions of you myself. Commissioner Dawson.
No, I think your evidence about Corbridge and Universal is very clear. I've got no questions about those. Thank you very much. I just, in your evidence, one of your evidences, you also cover some of the RVZ, some of the other zones. So can I just quickly ask you some short questions about those? The Gibson Valley RV zone, are you familiar with that?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, I can't remember whether you've covered it or not, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Yeah, yes, go for it.
It's a rebuttal evidence.
That's good. Are you generally satisfied with on-site wastewater disposal for an RVZ of this sort of scale, particularly on the site where they are anticipating the same the restrictions that would normally go into an RVZ, in other words? Basically only about 500 square metres of building before a resource consent is required. I mean, are you satisfied with on-site wastewater disposal and the ability for them to provide private water supply, including for firefighting, in a zone like this?
For wastewater to begin with, they don't really have much choice out there. I mean, we don't have any infrastructure out there to collect it. Whether or not they're going to be proposing some type of larger communal system rather than individual, that then could be vested in council, although I don't know why we would particularly want it.
For a relatively discreet development, which I think is all that could happen here under the rules, would you normally expect that on-site wastewater could be developed and not be required to be handed out over to the council?
Yes. Yep.
And similarly with on-site water supply?
Yes.
Yes. So that's sort of different than the Universal and Corbridge type scale of development. In other words, I'm trying to distinguish.
That is the biggest distinguish between the two that I continue to oppose and the others is the scale. I mean, a lot of the other ones can be incorporated and upgrades we've already got planned or current or simple upgrades that developers can do, and we have mechanisms to remove minor constraints in the networks, whereas things on this type of scale is a complete rethink from source through to delivery.
Yeah. So even though Corbridge is asking for the same zone as Gibson Valley, the scale of what's proposed within them are so different that you're happy to have, you think different solutions will be required.
Yes.
Yeah. So So just going quickly, at Cardrona, just I suppose this is as much my information as anything. Could you, what is the situation for with wastewater disposal at Cardrona at the moment and in the long term?
Okay, at the moment I believe there's a number of private systems. This just quite recently, late last year, we signed an agreement with a developer to go on a joint venture for a new wastewater treatment plant out there.
Which would provide for the whole settlement eventually?
Correct, both the village, their development, and the Cardrona ski field, Alpine Resort.
Alright, so that would be standalone, but it would eventually deal with everybody, including the sorts of.
That's right, we plan on taking everyone offline off the private systems.
And that would provide for the expansions proposed through the current zone at Cardrona?
Yes. Yep.
And water supply, is that. What's the situation at Cardrona with water supply?
There's a number of private water supplies and reticulation networks. Ideally, we would like to take those all in-house. Put them all together, connect them all with the New Zealand drinking water standards becoming more stringent. My understanding is that there's a rule if there's private water systems out there that are non-compliant for 5 years, then the council has to take them over. So we're kind of trying to front foot that, and I believe assessments are already underway to get a kind of condition surveys of this networks to see what the cost of that is going to be for us to take over and if anything needs to be brought up to our standards.
So for the scale of additional development that is proposed through both the notified settlement and some little expansions that people are seeking to the settlement zone at Cardrona, you satisfied that though they might be part of a private scheme now, that they would be able to be looked at as part of your overall review and
yep.
Whatever's happening out
yeah,
there.
Definitely. I mean, the numbers we're talking about, from our point of view, are relatively small, and even if we did get networks modelled, they would be within the era of the model.
Yes. And with Luggett, that's been connected up at the moment to Project Pure for wastewater. What's the long-term water supply proposal for Luggett? Because this Lake Mackay is quite a reasonable size extension.
Yep. I'm not sure where they're at the moment, but I remember pre-COVID they were doing, pre-lockdown, etc., they were doing new bore tests down by the river on several locations, trying to find out where the best places to put them and where we can get the best yields from, and that would, the pumps, I can't remember, sorry, the figures of that they're expecting to get out of those, but it's
it will
provide for Luggett for
provide for Luggett
for
and
in the long
the
term.
Extensions of the proposed.
Yes.
All right, thank you very much for that, that's great, thank you.
No, infrastructure is just that general.
Thank you very much, Mr. Powell.
No problem.
Your input.
My pleasure.
We'll break for 5 minutes. Thank you.